Hi, I'm Allison Barringer, host of KCRW's Bodies podcast. It's a documentary show about medical mysteries. Each episode follows one person's health journey, and we uncover the societal forces that shape our health. Over the next hour, we'll be airing two episodes from our latest season. The first is about a woman named Crystal Kim and a cosmetic product she used for over 40 years. In the United States, federal cosmetic regulations haven't been updated since 1938, and these lax regulations have opened the door for dangerous and harmful beauty products. We're going to be talking a lot about the types of products marketed to women in this episode. And we just want to say that we understand that not all people with vaginas are women, and that not all women have vaginas. But since we're talking a lot about how these products were advertised, in this episode you'll hear the language that advertisers and researchers use, and they usually just say women when they mean cis women. Okay, here's our first story, the cost of Silky Soft. Crystal Kim was 10 years old when she joined her town's baseball team. It was the 1970s, and it was a big deal because it was the first year that they were allowing girls to play. Before her first practice, her mom had a talk with Crystal.
She just sat me down and she was like, okay, well, you will be becoming a young lady, and there's certain things that you need to take care of as far as hygiene and smelling good. And, you know, women have certain odors that we don't want coming out. So there's things that you can do to take care of yourself. And one of them is putting baby powder in your panties and under your arms and making sure that you stay dry so that you don't smell.
Crystal went off to practice. Growing up, there was always a big white bottle of Johnson & Johnson's baby powder underneath the sink in the bathroom. And from that day forward, she used it almost every day, sprinkling it on her body and in her underwear.
The routine was always, you know, shower with soap, lotion, Johnson & Johnson's powder, and deodorant. And in our community, we would always see like older girls with powder on their necks and in their cleavage. So that was kind of like a statement, like, I'm clean. See, I have my powder on. And that kind of stuck with me.
Nearly four decades later, when Crystal was 47 years old, she went in for fibroid surgery. She had been bleeding a lot during her menstrual cycle, and she was very anemic. The surgery was to shrink the fibroids. The surgery went well, and a year later, in 2014, she went in for a follow-up ultrasound. She was feeling healthy, but the doctor found something in her ovaries during the ultrasound. It looked like it might be cancer. They needed to do an exploratory surgery right away.
I said, if you find anything, just do what you need to do. I'm not having any more children. I'm okay with the hysterectomy.
When Crystal woke up from surgery, the doctors told her they had found cancer in her ovaries and they had done a full hysterectomy. They told her she would need to start chemo for her ovarian cancer right after she recovered from surgery. It all happened so fast and she had a lot of questions.
How? Why? Why didn't anybody see it? Where did it come from? How did I get it? And I was like, are you sure? Because he said, yeah, we're sure, we took everything out of you. And I was like, all right. I didn't know what to think.
Ovarian cancer is rare, but one of the most deadly cancers. The five-year survival rate is about 50%.
I asked the doctor if there was anything I could have done to prevent it. And he said, no. But he told me that the demographic is middle-aged, overweight white women who have never had children. I didn't fit into any of those demographics.
Dazed, Crystal went home to recuperate. While she was healing, she spent time on Facebook. And as she scrolled, she started seeing articles about a connection between ovarian cancer and Johnson & Johnson's baby powder. At first, she was a little skeptical.
Baby powder, it's in the name. Something that's for babies, why would it cause cancer if it's marketed to babies? You know, that doesn't even make sense in my mind.
But it did make her wonder, could baby powder have caused her cancer? Crystal decided to fill out an online questionnaire about her cancer and about her baby powder habits. And soon after, she got a call from a lawyer. After a lot of conversations with the law firm, Crystal signed on to join a group of women suing Johnson & Johnson, alleging that the company's baby powder caused their cancer. And as it turned out, she was one of thousands. Johnson & Johnson includes about 250 companies and sells products in nearly every country in the world. They make drugs and medical devices. They make Band-Aids and Benadryl and birth control. And their most well-known product, baby powder. Johnson & Johnson actually sells two kinds of baby powder in stores. One is made from cornstarch, and you'll see it labeled as cornstarch on the front of the bottle. But the more common version, that classic kind that we've all seen in drugstores, that is made from a mineral called talc. It's an ingredient in a lot of cosmetics, especially the ones that have that soft, velvety feel, like eyeshadow and face powders. It's mined from the earth and then crushed into talcum powder. And when you mine for talc, there's another mineral that's sometimes found next to it, and that is asbestos. Asbestos is highly carcinogenic and is the known cause of a deadly cancer called mesothelioma, and has also been linked to ovarian cancer. We talked to Sean Fitzgerald, a geologist and someone who's testified against Johnson & Johnson, and he explained that talc and asbestos are made of the same basic building blocks.
So if we have an asbestos deposit, there's talc somewhere in that deposit. If we have a talc deposit, we may have asbestos. It depends on exactly how the talc formed, but they're very closely related. They're the same mineral family, if you will.
By law, any talc used in cosmetics or personal hygiene products must be tested and certified as asbestos-free. But not all talcum powder on the market is asbestos-free. Sean has spent his career testing talc for asbestos and recently made headlines when he found asbestos in a makeup kit at Claire's, a store for preteen girls. He's also found asbestos in Johnson & Johnson's baby powder. And there are documents that show that Johnson & Johnson has known about the asbestos for a long time. Internal communication at the corporation shows that since the 1970s, the same decade that Crystal started playing baseball and using its baby powder, Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder had tested positive for small amounts of asbestos. Executives at the company were aware of the problem, but they didn't tell the FDA or warn consumers. And it's important to note, there are studies that show an association between talcum powder and ovarian cancer. But there was also recently one major study from a highly regarded medical journal that did not find an association between baby powder and ovarian cancer. We'll get into the specifics of these studies later. Around this time in the 70s and 80s, pediatricians actually stopped recommending talcum powder for babies. There's no medical benefit, and they were concerned about babies inhaling the powder. Throughout all of this, Johnson & Johnson has always maintained the same message. Their product is safe. In 2018, they posted a video of their CEO, Alex Gorsky, defending it.
So I want you to hear directly from me. We know that our talc is safe. In fact, for over 100 years, Johnson & Johnson has known that the talc in our baby powder is the purest, safest pharmaceutical-grade talc on Earth. J&J's baby powder has never contained asbestos.
But less than a year later, in 2019, Johnson & Johnson did a recall on 33,000 bottles of baby powder after the FDA found small amounts of asbestos in one of the bottles. This was the first time that Johnson & Johnson had ever done a recall in baby powder because of asbestos. This video is still posted on their website. So is talcum powder safe, or isn't it? Johnson & Johnson's reassurances didn't make Crystal feel any better, especially once she started learning more about her own body. After Crystal signed on to be part of this lawsuit against J&J, the law firm started collecting evidence for her trial. One piece of evidence was a sample of Crystal's tissue that had been removed during her hysterectomy. The law firm sent some of that tissue to an expert. The test results showed that there was talc in the tissue of her ovaries and fallopian tubes, and that there was asbestos in her lymph nodes.
I'm just like, are you kidding me? And I just cried. That's when all the dots were connected. It was like, wow. I've used this for all my life. I used to put it in my hair, put it in my makeup, put it on my dog, put it in my sheets, in my pillowcases. So I'm rolling around in it all night. Everybody knows asbestos is deadly. And it's like, oh my God, I got to get a will. Who's going to take care of my children? And, you know, My mind was spinning. It was just going so fast because I was just thinking about everything that needed to be done before I died, because I knew I was just going to die.
So there's a big element of this story that we want to focus on, and that's race. Studies show that Black women use baby powder at higher rates compared to white women. And to talk more about all this, I wanted to bring on one of our reporters, Kalaisha Tati. Hey, Kalaisha.
Hi, Allison.
So, Kalaisha, before you started working on this story, what was your experience with baby powder?
My grandma used it on me. My mom used it on me. It's something that I had never thought twice about. My mom said in the summertime, she would put it in her sheets to keep her cool and dry. My grandma used to, like, put it under her boobs and, like, some people put it in their hair, on their legs. Like, it's kind of like once you get out of the shower, you get out of the bath, you put baby powder in your underwear and you're good to go, basically.
Why are women putting baby powder in their underwear? Like, where is that thing coming from?
So advertisers tried to push this idea that women needed to improve the smell of their bodies, particularly their vaginal odor. As early as the 1920s, companies like Lysol were marketing their disinfectant spray as a douche to women.
So wait, so like the same product that they're telling people to like clean their house with, they're telling women to use that on their vaginas?
Yeah, I know. So yeah, I found a bunch of these old commercials from like the 70s and the 80s and the 90s for vaginal products. Do you want to watch some of them?
Yes, definitely. Please.
Okay, so one of these commercials is from the 80s for a feminine wash called Summer's Eve.
Okay, what is Summer's Eve?
So it's basically a soap specifically made for your vagina.
Oh my God. Okay, let's see it.
The following is for women only. Summer's Eve introduces a new and totally different idea. The first external feminine
wash. It's like a silhouette of her. She's like getting undressed. It's so sexy.
And it's non-irritating. So you can use it every day to help you feel feminine, fresh, and confident. New Summer's Eve.
So I found a lot of ads for vaginal deodorant products.
And like, so as you were going through all these, like, what was your overall impression of them?
It implies that your natural body odors are an issue that need to be dealt with.
But when I want to feel naturally fresh and clean, there's one thing I know I can trust. Massengill Douche. It's been in my family forever. For that 100% fresh, clean feeling.
Trust Massengill Douche for freshness you can be sure of.
And so what's the deal with douching? Like, why are so many women using douching products?
The idea is that, you know, you douche after sex to, like, clean yourself out. And you douche after your period or when you're on your period to clean yourself out. It's just this idea that you need to clean yourself out. Today, we know that OBGYNs do not recommend douching because it can be very harmful. You're putting products up your vagina that don't belong there. But here's the thing. We found that Black women in particular use these vaginal deodorant products at higher rates than white women. And it made me curious and ask why.
How do you know that it's not a cultural norm and that marketers are not actually responding to the cultural norm?
So that's Bhavna Shamasunder, an associate professor at Occidental College. Her work looks at how low-income communities and communities of color are more negatively impacted by toxic chemicals. There's a question that people ask her over and over about her research, and it's something that she thinks a lot about too. Basically, is this just a Black thing? And she says no.
I think the pressures really do originate outside of the community and then are perpetuated within the community. I think the advertising messages were insidious and told a falsehood, and people believed it.
It wasn't inherent in Black communities. It was popular because it was specifically pushed on Black women by advertisers. So one of the researchers I found, named Michelle Ferranti, looked at how douching was advertised differently to Black women and white women throughout the 1970s. Specifically, she looked at white magazines like Life and Black magazines like Ebony and found that there were no ads for douching in Life, but there were a lot more in Ebony magazine.
Okay, so yeah, this was clearly an intentional advertising decision that companies made. So then it makes sense that Black women would be using these products more.
Exactly. And as women, we know we're held to a higher beauty standard than men. even though we know some of the stuff we use, like nail polish and hairspray, is probably not good for us, we keep using it. There's all this sexist messaging and advertising that our vaginas smell, that we need to be skinny. But for some Black women, that standard is even higher. That need to look clean and presentable in order to fit into white spaces. Like in the United States, many schools will still not allow Black girls to wear their hair natural. And the more you try to change your body, the harsher the chemicals need to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. And is there research on this?
Yeah, studies actually show that products marketed to Black women are generally more dangerous. In one study, researchers found that Black women who douched had more phthalates in their body, which is a chemical that negatively affects reproductive health. Another study tested household and beauty products to see which ones were the most toxic. And the most toxic product was called Just For Me. It's a hair relaxer kit, which permanently straightens your hair. And it was marketed specifically to Black girls.
Oh, wow. So even young Black girls are getting hit with these kinds of messages.
You know, we talk a lot about how these corporations are racist, but sometimes it's hard to pin down exactly how. But I feel like after doing this research, it's really clear white beauty standards aren't just dangerous to our self-esteem. They're actually dangerous to our health.
And here is where we come back to baby powder. Internal documents from the early 90s show that J&J's baby powder sales were declining, and that if they targeted African-American women, they could boost these sales. So they shifted their marketing plans. And then, about a decade later in 2006, the World Health Organization said that using talcum powder in the genital area is possibly carcinogenic. Johnson & Johnson's baby powder sales started to fall even more as people became aware of the possible risks. We looked at some internal PowerPoints from that time period and found that J&J doubled down on its marketing efforts to African-American women. J&J made plans to hand out free samples of baby powder at Black churches and beauty salons. I asked Crystal whether she remembers seeing ads that she felt like were specifically targeted to her.
We didn't know that it was specific to the African-American community because we were in it, so we didn't see other communities. So we're thinking everybody's getting this marketing. Everybody sees this commercial. Everybody sees this poster or whatever. So it didn't dawn on me until a reporter called me about it and told me. And I was like, are you kidding me? Johnson & Johnson knew for decades that it had asbestos in it. So when white women stopped using it, they figured, okay, we'll get the money from the Black women and make them feel that they need to smell better, or our product is going to make them smell better and feel smoother or whatever. But ultimately, it's going to kill them.
In a statement, Johnson & Johnson wrote that, quote, our campaigns are multicultural and inclusive. We are proud that we have been the pioneers in multicultural marketing. Here's Kalaisha again.
It wasn't bad that Johnson & Johnson was marketing to Black women. It was that they were using stereotypes linked to Black women to manipulate us and to encourage us to buy a potentially dangerous product. And like, does it make me mad? Yeah, of course it makes me mad. But to be honest, it's not surprising. Because Black people have always gotten the short end of the stick on everything, no matter what. We're treated as if we're disposable, like we're an afterthought.
In 2018, Crystal traveled to Missouri for the trial, and she met the other women who will be part of this case. The trial went on for 6 weeks, Johnson & Johnson making their case, the law firm, and the women making theirs, each calling experts, each referring to studies. One of the big questions in this case, of course, is whether talcum powder causes ovarian cancer. This has been difficult to answer. The best way to figure this out would be to put humans in a lab and expose them to a potentially carcinogenic powder. Obviously, scientists can't do that. Studies that survey women about their baby powder habits have shown mixed results. One of the early studies that found a link was in 1982 by a Harvard doctor named Daniel Kramer. In a study of 215 women, he found that those who used talc on their genitals were at a 92% increased risk for ovarian cancer. Dr. Kramer wrote a letter to J&J and recommended that they put a warning label on their baby powder. But Johnson & Johnson did not put a warning label on. In the time since, there's been over 20 mostly small studies that have found an increased risk. But other studies did not find a link. In January of this year, a highly regarded medical journal called JAMA published the largest study to date, and found no statistically significant association between baby powder use and ovarian cancer. We spoke to the lead researcher on this study, Katie O'Brien, and she talked about the strengths of the study, that it included more than 250,000 American women. The researchers pooled data from several long-running studies that were following women over the course of their lives. And they found that rates of ovarian cancer were roughly similar in women who didn't use powder on their genital area and those who did. But there are some major issues with this study, which the authors acknowledge. First, the studies they pulled from did not collect information on what kinds of powder products women used. So we can't know if the people who said they used powder were using cornstarch or talc. Second, this is a very rare cancer. Out of the about 250,000 women in this study, less than 1% got ovarian cancer. And so it's tricky to figure out small differences in risk when you're working with such small numbers to begin with. Isabel Chaudhry talks about the third limitation. She's the senior policy manager at the National Women's Health Network in Washington, D.C., and she advocates for safer cosmetic legislation.
That study is dangerously flawed. The study relies on a cohort that was almost exclusively composed of middle-class white women.
In fact, 98% of the women in the study were white women. When you look at the chart of demographics, all the other races are lumped into one category of 2% and labeled other. So it didn't include the women who use these products the most.
I was very upset. The study almost completely erased Black women and other women of color. Like I said, we know who uses these products more, and women of color are the most impacted by this issue. Like, for instance, a Black woman who's reading this article and thinking it's safe to use talc-based products, but the study does not even consider them. And so that is very problematic.
So we can't totally throw out this massive study's findings, but we can hope for more data and research that is diverse. Until more information is available, the American Cancer Society says that people concerned about using talcum powder might want to avoid it or limit using it. With all these questions about safety, it makes you wonder, why do we have so many products like baby powder and douches and hair relaxers on the market? How did they even get there in the first place? Technically, we're supposed to have protections against dangerous products. But unfortunately, that's not really the case right now. The United States Cosmetics Act has not been updated in over 80 years. As the law stands now, the FDA has very little regulatory power or resources to test the safety of products. It's up to the companies themselves to ensure their own products are safe, but they don't need to send that data about testing or even register their products and ingredients with the FDA. Companies have been left to regulate themselves. As of today, the U.S. has only banned 11 chemicals from products. In comparison, the European Union has banned over 1,000 chemicals. Companies will create European versions of their products without the banned chemicals, but in the U.S., they keep the chemicals in. So it's not as if companies can't make these products without them. It's just that it's easier and less expensive to do so. People at the FDA know that this is a problem, and they're asking Congress for more resources. But it's a slow process. The only time the FDA can test a product is if they have concerns over its safety. This happens to less than 1% of products. And this is how they found the asbestos in baby powder in 2019. But Johnson & Johnson has disputed these findings, saying that it was a problem with the testing. And Johnson & Johnson continues to share the same message.
J&J's baby powder has never contained asbestos.
When we contacted Johnson & Johnson for an interview, they responded in an email reiterating the message from Alex Gorsky, that their products are safe. They also included a link to the JAMA study, the one that was 98% white women and did not differentiate between cornstarch and baby powder. The shortcomings of the Cosmetic Act hurt all Americans, but they especially impact women who, on average, use 20 products a day. And they impact Black women even more because those products are generally more toxic. This is what a racist system looks like. This is what happens when companies like Johnson & Johnson are allowed to regulate themselves. When Crystal heard all this information at the trial, she got angry.
I felt like they bamboozled us. All of their advertisements, it's pure, it's for babies, it's And they knew. They knew. It's like a kid that's caught in a lie. You're going to keep lying? You're going to keep lying. When, at one point, do you tell the truth and just make it right? I have no trust, because finding out that the FDA allowed Johnson & Johnson to police themselves, that's like having the fox watch the chicken coop.
On the final day of Crystal's trial, she and the other women gathered outside the courtroom.
It was just, we knew, it was just a feeling. It was, the sun was out, and it was just, everybody was smiling. It was just a good day.
The jury awarded the 22 plaintiffs $4.69 billion, which comes out to about $200 million per plaintiff.
It was just the confirmation of what we already felt. So, you know, it was just roars and cheers, and it was good. It was good. We're real people, and this is something that happened to us. This is not just something that you read in the news or watch on television. We are real people, and hear my story. Hear what happened to me.
But Crystal and her fellow plaintiffs have not seen any of this money because Johnson & Johnson appealed the ruling. In the time since the trial, only 12 of the 22 plaintiffs are still living. Two of those 12 are very sick. In the past year, there has been more mesothelioma and ovarian cancer trials against Johnson & Johnson. In a couple of these, the jury sided with J&J. In others, juries ordered J&J to pay out tens of millions of dollars. Just this February, CEO Alex Gorsky testified for the first time, and that jury awarded nearly $40 million to the plaintiffs. But J&J keeps standing their ground, even though there is a perfectly safe alternative. They could stop making the talcum powder version and make all their baby powder from cornstarch. As far as Crystal's health, she's been in remission for almost 5 years.
It's the beginning of another journey to stay this way. So at the five-year mark, they have a big party. And at 5 years, that's when they deem you cancer-free. So I saw tents at the cancer center. I went for an appointment one day. I was like, what's going on here? And they were like, that's a five-year and more party. So that's my goal, to get to that party.
How far away from you?
This will be my fourth year. August will be my fourth year. So I have a year and a couple of months to go.
Currently, some leaders in Congress are proposing an update to the Cosmetics Act. And the FDA is working on ensuring talc testing methods are the most sensitive and accurate. But in the meantime, there are actions that we can take to have more information about beauty products. The Environmental Working Group has a tool called Skin Deep where you can type in your product and find out its safety rating. But lots of beauty products come with risks. And what do we do with that? For Crystal, changing our ideas of what is beautiful may be our best safeguard.
You have to love yourself, because you don't want to fall prey to the standards of beauty. And I think a lot of us, because Johnson & Johnson targeted the Black community because the standard of beauty was the white image, the straight hair. You know, we weren't supposed to be pretty because we had kinky hair or darker skin. So love yourself. Don't fall prey to that.
I've been thinking a lot about Crystal's idea of loving ourselves. But does loving ourselves mean never using makeup? Does it mean not using shampoo? Does it mean giving up eyeshadow and nail polish and all the other products we use to have fun? Because even if we do love ourselves, it doesn't mean that society will. We still live in a world where natural vaginal odor is considered a problem to be fixed. We still live in a world where Black women are treated better at work if they relax their hair. So how do we figure out which practices we just love because they make us feel happy, and which ones have been encoded into us by society and history and marketing? When I talked to reporter Kalaisha about this, she isn't just thinking about herself. She's pregnant and about to give birth any day now to a daughter. And she's been trying to figure out how she's going to parse this all out. How has doing this research while pregnant impacted what you've been thinking about and how you want to raise your daughter?
Honestly, it has scared the hell out of me. I'm not going to lie, because I have to be responsible with bringing a new life into this world that seems so bad and so out to get you. And being a Black woman, I'm just like, you know, it's like I can't control anything, but I'm trying to give her the best choice. So like me and my mom were talking about, you know, what baby products do I use? What kind of soap? What kind of diapers? What kind of a wipe? I was kind of like losing my mind over this because now that I'm more knowledgeable, I'm trying to make all these decisions, but it seems as though it's impossible to keep her 100% safe. Like if it's not the diapers, it's the smog in the air. If it's not the smog, it's the racism. It's just like there's so much stuff. So it's empowered me to know that I can make more informed decisions. And really, it starts with educating ourselves to educate our children. Every person has the right to make their own decisions, but if we share what we know, we're empowering a whole community to make better choices. And I guess at the end of the day, that's really all that we can hope for.
Every day, we make choices about how to care for our bodies. We slather them with lotions and cleansers, wash them with shampoo, maybe even dust them with powder. But sometimes, caring for our bodies means doing nothing at all, even when we've been told otherwise our whole lives. While I've been working on this episode, I've been wondering about my own makeup and shampoo and soap. So the other day, I went to the Environmental Working Group's website and I looked up all my products. I ended up throwing about half of it away. To Kalaisha's point, it's a small change in a world full of pesticides and air pollution, and who knows what else. But gathering that knowledge and then deciding what to keep and what to throw away, that actually made me feel more confident, kind of like any good makeup should. An update on the story you just heard. A few weeks after we aired the episode this spring, Johnson & Johnson announced that it would stop selling talc-based baby powder in the United States and Canada, and that it would only sell cornstarch baby powder in these two countries. Johnson & Johnson said this decision had nothing to do with the safety of the product. The reason they gave was that the demand for talc-based powder was falling, and that the slump in sales was related to the, quote, misinformation in lawsuits and media coverage. The company repeated that they would stand by the safety of talc and will, quote, vigorously defend the product in court. And the lawsuits have continued. Last month, a New York State judge ordered Johnson & Johnson to pay $120 million to a woman and her husband after she blamed her cancer on their baby powder. Meanwhile, outside of the U.S. and Canada, Johnson & Johnson continues to sell talc-based baby powder in many countries all over the world. In August, a nonprofit called Black Women for Wellness published a letter they wrote to the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Alex Gorsky. Over 200 nonprofits from 50 different countries signed the letter. They wrote that Johnson & Johnson's choice to continue selling talc-based baby powder internationally, often to Black and brown people, contradicts a statement that Alex Gorsky made in June, where he committed to fighting racial inequality. This letter from Black Women for Wellness calls Johnson & Johnson to walk its talk on racial equity and valuing Black lives by completely discontinuing the product and the sale of talc-based baby powder. As of today, Johnson & Johnson is still making and selling its talc baby powder. Coming up after the break, we're talking with a pregnancy doula who advocates for Black families and hearing about what it's like to give birth and to care for a newborn during a pandemic. I'm Allison Barringer, and you're listening to a special broadcast of Bodies Podcast. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hi, it's Allison Barringer. You're listening to a special broadcast of Bodies, a documentary podcast I host and produce with KCRW. That story you just heard, The Cost of Silky Soft, is from season 2 of Bodies, which came out in the spring of this year. right as the pandemic was coming into full effect. And at that time, there was so much talk about the implications of COVID-19 for people who were pregnant, what it meant for their own health and for the health of their babies, and not just during their pregnancy, but during postpartum, the time after a person gives birth. Here it is, our episode, Postpartum in a Pandemic.
Hello. Hi.
Hey, Kalaisha.
You can hear me, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Do you have your microphone set up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I think we're good.
Okay, great. How are you doing?
Doing fabulous. She's in my arms. She just fell asleep right before you called me.
And what's her name?
Her name is Magnolia, like the flower.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the magnolia flowers are blooming in Brooklyn right now. I'm on the phone with Kalaisha Toddy. You might recognize her voice from our last episode. She's the reporter who talked to us about Johnson & Johnson baby powder and the marketing of dangerous beauty products.
Because actually one of the baby shower gifts that I got was like a Johnson & Johnson gift set. And I'm like side-eyeing that. And I'm like, I don't know about that now. Like, I'm not sure. So yeah, I got
And if you remember, Kalaisha was also very pregnant. She had her baby last week, and so I gave her a call to see how she was doing.
Through my entire pregnancy, I was basically self-isolating just because I didn't feel well. I didn't have any energy. So I was really excited to have my baby because I was like, you know, I'll feel like myself again. I'll be able to take her out. So from going from 9 months of isolation to indefinite isolation, it's been really hard to kind of cope with. Like, I cried for like the first few days because I was just like, I don't know what to do. I can't sit in bed all day. Like, I'm disappointed that I can't do the things that I wanted to do. Like, there were days where I was just like, I don't even know what I did all day. Like, it was just 9 o'clock in the morning and now it's 9 o'clock at night and I don't even know what I did. Like, I feel like I just stared at a wall all day. But I had to like tell myself, like, you know, no amount of crying is going to fix anything. You just have to make an alternate plan. So one thing that I try to do is get up in the morning. I take a shower just to like, you know, get dressed. I put on real clothes every day. I have like a routine of like when she eats, when she sleeps, when I change her. And then I try to go on walks just around my apartment complex just to get outside. Because for a whole week, I didn't leave the bed, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I can understand that. Well, the last thing I wanted to ask about, I mean, it sounds like a lot of really, really tough stuff, but like, can you tell me about a fun moment, like a moment of joy?
She smiles in her sleep, uh-huh. And I can't get a picture because it's so fast, but it's the cutest. Oh my gosh, I'm obsessed with her little face. She's so cute. But also seeing my fiance with her, like he sings to her, the way he talks to her. I didn't know I could ever be more in love than I already am now. But I'm just like, seeing them together is just the best thing I've ever experienced in my life. Aww. So I'm very fortunate that he gets to be home with us.
This is Bodies, a show about people solving the mysteries of their bodies. I'm Allison Behringer. Today, we're taking a break from our usual documentary storytelling to talk about something that's really important right now, and that's postpartum, the time after you give birth. This is a topic that I've been wanting us to cover since I started Bodies. I've spoken to so many parents and birth workers over the years, and it's become really clear to me that we just don't support mothers and birthing parents enough after the baby comes. After a person gives birth, there's a drop-off in their hormone levels, which has an effect on emotions and brain functioning. There's also lack of sleep, not to mention a huge life change. I think most people know about postpartum depression, but there are other mental health issues like postpartum anxiety and postpartum psychosis. A lot of the experts I've talked to have said that one of the first lines of defense against this is community support. But how do we find that support in the middle of a pandemic? With social distancing and stay-at-home orders in place, postpartum can be even more isolating and lonely. One of the people we spoke to for this episode is Shishi Rose. She's an activist, an educator, and a doula. As a doula, her job is to support people from pregnancy to postpartum, like helping them create a birth plan or find a good pediatrician. And she specializes in advocacy for Black families. Compared to white women, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth and the postpartum period, which includes up to a year after birth. In New York City, where Shishi lives, Black women are up to 12 times more likely to die. Research has shown that two of the biggest factors are medical racism and weathering, which is when stress from racism affects physical health. And so Shishi's doula work isn't just about providing emotional support. It can also be about saving a person's life. Like this one time, after Shishi's client gave birth, the doctor didn't check the placenta to see if it was intact. And so Shishi stepped in. And it turned out there was an issue with the placenta. And if she hadn't been there, her client could have gone home and hemorrhaged to death. On top of her work as a doula, she just gave birth herself to a baby girl named Sula. Shishi was in labor for 12 days. And when Sula did arrive...
I remember crying a lot. Like ugly crying. And I remember her crying, and like the way that like newborns, their little mouths are, they just like the way that they scream is just really funny. Yeah, we were just like crying together.
Shishi is a single mom, and she's been home alone with her daughter for a few weeks now. I spoke with her on the phone when she was nursing. So I want to start with your pregnancy. I'm wondering, given your knowledge and your profession as a doula, when you were pregnant with Sula, what were some of the things that you were doing to advocate for yourself and prepare for the postpartum time?
I think that I was concerned about possibly getting postpartum depression just because I do have a history of depression. And I had to get off of my antidepressant when I was pregnant because it wasn't safe for the baby. And I was just like looking for whatever type of body type therapy alternatives that I could find. So acupuncture was really helpful for that. And then I also was in therapy with two different therapists. I feel like I worked really hard in my pregnancy to ensure that I had the mental health support that I felt like I needed. And that a part of that was me. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Part of that was me heavily planning the postpartum time in order to prevent, not that you can prevent postpartum depression, but in my brain, in order to prevent it from happening, I am a heavy planner. And I'm like, if I plan everything and I organize everything and I get like support that I need and I'm not like isolated by myself in those early weeks, then, you know, things are going to go better. And so, yeah, I was and still am very concerned about mental health in this postpartum time.
And what else did you know about postpartum mood and anxiety disorders going in? Like, I feel like people a little bit like know about postpartum depression, but I feel like the broader public doesn't necessarily like have all the knowledge about the different ways that that can look.
Well, I think one thing too that is definitely left out of the discussion is postpartum anxiety. I feel like everybody instantly goes for depression, but a lot of people have postpartum anxiety and it presents in like so many different ways that there's not even like one like by the rule book, you know, way that it can look because everybody's anxiety shows up differently. And I feel like postpartum anxiety is harder to pinpoint because as a new parent, you're already so anxious. A lot of the things that it says, like the books say about postpartum anxiety, about like watching the baby when the baby sleeps and like you think that something bad is going to happen to the baby and like all that, like that's just being a new parent in general. So it's really hard to lock down when that becomes more excessive. So I feel like that goes underdiagnosed and underreported a lot. And a lot of people don't get support around it because people don't know what's normal and what's not. So I felt like as much information as I knew about postpartum depression, I was not prepared for postpartum anxiety as much as I should have been. And I feel like that has been what has like come more into play than the depression.
Yeah. So, and I know you had your own doula in this. What were some of the things that your doula was helping you do?
My postpartum doula came to my baby shower and basically passed around a notebook to everybody so that they could sign up for jobs for postpartum. And at first I like didn't want to do it because I just felt like I didn't want to like ask my friends that bluntly to be like, hey, can you guys take my trash out and do my dishes? But I actually had several friends after the baby shower that were like, that was so cool that your postpartum doula did that. And they're like, I always want to like support friends that have a baby, but I never know like what to do. I also like this idea of asking people to show up in this time, because this is not meant to be done alone. And even for people who are single, and or people who choose to be single parents or whatever, like, it's, you're never supposed to like parent alone. There's supposed to be a community aspect to all of this.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And so, you know, you come home from the hospital, it's end of February, beginning of March, we're still a couple weeks away from the CDC announcing that there's a pandemic. And so what was that first week at home like?
The first week was like everything that I had planned with my doulas. It was me being fed and people bringing me drinks and, you know, staying over to help with the baby and my postpartum doula, like, massaging my body because I was so swollen from the birth. And it felt amazing that basically, like, I pulled it off. Like, it actually worked. They actually showed up. And I'm really grateful for that. Everybody was kind of, like, on a schedule of, like, who could do what when and, like, who could do overnights and stuff. And it was really nice for, like, a week and a half to have that and to have them coming over and helping me get a break and just like loving on us and everything. And then this corona situation hit. And yeah, that kind of all went out the window.
Shishi felt prepared to be a single mom, but not like this. After about a week of being home with Sula, the governor of New York City put a stay-at-home order in place. And all the people that were supposed to show up couldn't come anymore.
We're stuck in isolation, and that's not something that I would really wish on anybody that was in the immediate stages of postpartum or really just in parenthood in general. It sucks. I don't even know how to like describe it, because it's like the exact opposite of what is needed during this time. So many people were ready and willing to show up. It is nice that we have that support system, and that when this is over, we will still have that to rely on. People were jumping on Zoom calls like nonstop and like doing like Zoom hangouts and all these like Zoom events. And I'm just like, where was this energy before when, you know, we were all so busy with our lives constantly? And so I like do like that we've been told to slow down and like forced to talk to each other. I do hope that after this whole thing is over, or whatever life looks like when it's over, I hope that like people continue to show up with the same energy and like really show up for each other.
If you're just joining us, this is Bodies Podcast. I'm talking with Shishi Rose, an activist and doula who is at home in New York City with her newborn baby. The coronavirus outbreak has not only changed her own postpartum plans, it's also impacting her work as a doula.
Yeah, so the plan before I had her had basically been that I was going to like take off from doula work for a while. But since all of this happened, I've realized that there's a lot more need for virtual care, because that's the model that most doulas are having to switch to right now, is to like virtually support clients. Now they can have one partner with them, but now they still have to choose between having a doula or their like husband or wife or like whatever other partner, maybe their best friend or whoever was supposed to be there. So mostly it's just helping them to prepare for what life is going to look like birthing during this pandemic.
Do you feel like doulas are more important now? And do you feel like they're more important for the Black families that you work with?
I wouldn't say that they're more important now during the pandemic, but doulas were always important. Having a supportive person to help guide you through your birth process and advocate for you and support you, that's like always important. And I think that everybody deserves a doula, but marginalized communities like Black community does need doulas more than anybody else, because they need that person there advocating for them. They need that person there telling them that they're going to do okay, and that they can like, they can advocate for themselves, and that they can have the birth that they want when everyone has been telling them that they can't have it.
You know, a lot of people have been talking about how the coronavirus has exposed gaps in our healthcare system or shortcomings in our healthcare system. And I was just curious, like, what you think about that?
I think it's really interesting that people are acting like these gaps were not exposed this entire time. Because Black people have been screaming about all these gaps in the medical system constantly. People didn't kind of like wake up until white women were told that they couldn't have their doulas in the room with them. You know, Black people have been trying to fight against hospital policy and unfair policies for forever. We've been talking about medical racism and unfair practices and doctors inducing for no reason and doctors doing C-sections for no reason and, you know, us really needing to change the way the medical system works and families deserving better. And like, we've been trying to like advocate around this for so long. And so it's almost like offensive to think that people are saying that these gaps in the healthcare industry have been exposed because of the coronavirus. Then it's like, what the hell have we been yelling about all this time?
What is your advice for people, especially marginalized people? What's your advice about giving birth, preparing for the postpartum period during this time?
My advice would be to take in as much information as you possibly can. Try to find yourself a virtual doula if you can. There's a lot that are doing free and sliding scale options for the people that can't afford it. I'm one of those people. Just find as much information as you can, because basically you're going to have to be your own doula if you're going in there without one. And to be your own doula means that you're going to have to like understand how the system works in more ways than you would have if you had a doula there with you. Like, really dig deep into what you want your birth plan to look like, how you plan to get them to like listen to your birth plan, like maybe also being open to the fact that plans change. Educating yourself and being open, I feel like, are the two biggest things that I can suggest.
Things didn't go the way that she wanted, not in her birth or her postpartum, but she's creating new plans to adjust and adapt. Shishi's friends drop off groceries at the door, and she's seen one of her friends who agreed to also self-isolate so she could safely visit Shishi. She says that the human contact and having someone there caring for her has been really important to her mental health. And she's doing her best to focus on caring for herself and Sula and thinking about the future.
I'm looking forward to just seeing my friends and like having her around my friends, and I'm looking forward to hugs and parties and looking forward to holding people's hands again. Like, that'd be great without worrying. It's hard to be this isolated, and it is depressing and sad. But at the same time, I don't want to look back on this and only see like sad times. I mean, every day with her is joy. Even right now, she's just like smiling at me so much. It's joy, too. It's all of the things at once, which is just parenthood in general.
Thank you, Shishi Rose, for her time. In reporting for this episode, we spoke to lots of experts and parents. Some of them told us what they were missing. Others offered advice.
Think of the power that people had before in terms of laboring alone and birthing alone. Yes, it's not the ideal, but people have been doing it for centuries, right? Like, I talk about childbirth being a very intuitive process that you really need to learn how to trust yourself. You really need to know how to trust your instinct.
Immediately, as soon as you're feeling your feelings, feel them, first of all. You just gave birth, so you know what it's like to feel the pain and let the pain pass. So let your feelings be similar. Let the feelings come and feel them. It's a little painful, you know, because, you know, I wanted, you know, so much more. And I'm such a big supporter of that. Like, you know, we celebrate life, a new life in our family, like most families, you know. And we want to be there and cook and have the house smelling like good food and hold the baby for the mommy and make all these jokes. You know, even now, like, I'm tearing up, I'm letting myself fully express my feeling, and I'm not trying to stop my emotion.
So we were looking forward to a different kind of maternity leave where we met for coffee and took walks with the babies and got out of the house together. When you're sleep deprived, that coffee with a friend it's like Disneyland. You know, when is it going to be over? That's the hard part, is not knowing.
Do some screaming if you need to. If you need to do a primal scream in the car, go ahead. I get it, you know? We are seeing people, pregnant people and families, really having to dig deep and do more than they thought they were ever going to have to do. They already knew they were going to have to dig deep to birth, but this is a whole other level.
We took all the advice you just heard and more and put together an online resource for birthing and postpartum during COVID. To read about these resources and our interviews with doulas, doctors, and new moms, go to kcrw.com/bodies. A big thanks to all the people we spoke to for this episode, some of whom you just heard. Tiana Souffrant, Dr. Helena Wiesing, Kim Summer-Zuliger, Kim Borchert, Claire Nichols, Jillian Eldridge, Tara Brooke, Dr. Mary DeVera, Takesha White, Paige Bellenbaum, Dr. Kelly Treeter, Dr. Jennifer King, Shannon O'Brien, and F.A. Osarin. These episodes were produced by me, Allison Behringer, with Hannah Harris Green as associate producer and Kristen Lepore as managing producer. Kalaisha Tati reported the Talcum Powder episode. Story editing by Kala Leah and Stephanie Fu, with additional editorial support from Caitlin Pierce, Cassius Adair, Lisa Krieger, and Catherine Stifter. Original score and sound design by Dara Hirsch. Mixing by Mike Dodge Weiskopf. This broadcast was engineered by Kathleen Yore. Research support from Liz Charkey. For the Talcum Powder episode, we received support from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. Special thanks to Lisa Girion, as well as Phyllis Ellis. Our cover artwork is by Sarah Bachman, episode art by Nika King. If this is your first time listening, I want to invite you to join The Bodies Facebook group. Nothing is off the table and everyone is welcome. It's a place where you can share your reactions to episodes, post articles, ask for doctor recommendations, or just find support for a health challenge you're going through. You can find a link to The Bodies Facebook group by going to kcrw.com/bodies. You can follow Bodies on Twitter at Bodies Podcast and me at Albie Tweetin, ALBTWEETIN, and on Instagram at ALB1919. I'm Allison Behringer. Thank you for listening to this special broadcast of Bodies. To hear more episodes about medical mysteries and the layers that affect our health, find Bodies wherever you get your podcasts.